overflowing with love. I am overflowing with happiness. I am filled with the power to make a change. You create a brand new life. I am overflowing.
Welcome to the podcast of the Sunday Celebration from the Center for Spiritual Living in Huntsville, Alabama. We hope you feel the grace, the beauty, and the love of our community as you hear the message of the week.
Ernest Hemingway says, for whom the bell tolls, he says, the bell tolls for thee. And in that sweet statement, there is the opportunity to allow our consciousness to quiet. And in that quieting, there is an aspect of our being that can listen, not for the narrative of the mind, which will go on and on and on, as they say in the South, but to listen to the wisdom of the jubilant and beholden soul that lies stretched in smiling repose at the center of all life, which is our shared true nature. And we come into this Sangha, into this community of truth, to entrain ourselves to the very thing that we are, that perhaps we have forgotten. And so in truth, the simplicity of what we do here is to remember. I am remembering who I am. Who I am is not an individual self. And when we become absorbed with the self, it's almost like self-hatred. We're hating the true self because we're immersed in the egoic self, the me that wears all the masks, that has all the roles that we play. And today I'm going to be shedding masks, and the invitation is to expose our naked soul once again, which is free to dance as if no one is watching, which is free to be soulfully selfish and do things that the world might frown at, but yet the soul wants to celebrate and express as. And so we come here today to explore a new design for living, knowing that we're very familiar with the old design that's predicated on appearance. But Jesus said, judge not by according to appearance, but judge righteously. So he was saying, use our judgment in a right way. Could we discern what is expansive for a well-lived life? And can we also discern what is contracting and not life-affirming? Perhaps there is a path that we have followed in the past that was begging on the world's approval. And then you get to a place where you don't beg on the world anymore for its validation. You begin to find a sense of belonging to the universe. And it's not a frightening place anymore. It's a liberating place. It was Wayne Dyer that said, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. So instead of seeing the world and all of this transformation that is going on planet Earth as a problem to be solved, perhaps we can see it as a death and a rebirth. There is a beautiful enlightened teacher from Canada named Stephen Jenkinson, and he wrote a book called Die Well. And he has a series on Canadian public television on being an elder in the tribe. And he talks about the elders not as a consequence of getting old, but as a sacred place of spiritual maturity that we all arrive at when we cease to identify with conditions on the external, and we begin to discover that there is this wellspring of awareness what Thomas Merton called a hidden wholeness within all of us, and we begin to access that wholeness as we evolve, as we continue to grow spiritually. And then we can say, I'm a spiritual being and I'm having a human experience, and they're not in conflict with one another. Richard Rohr has written a beautiful book about honoring the 12-step program spiritually. And I may be teaching it in the next class, so I read the first chapter this week, and he talked about that first step of being powerless as the willingness to die to an old sense of self, an old design for living. Perhaps it's the victim consciousness that's ready to die. And then we begin to perceive that there is a new way to emerge out of that false identification of an addict and a victim into a co-creator with this mystery of something that we get to surrender into and that supports us and lifts us up and expands us into an intimacy with life, an intimacy with the moment. And then you begin to see the divine wherever you look. My sweet husband reminded me this morning, he woke up and there was a hummingbird at the bedroom window looking in. And we smiled to the hummingbird. I said, they're back. And then we went out into the yard and we saw the robins making hay, if you know what I mean. And we realized spring is here. And when we feel this connection to this emerging life, well, then something alchemically begins to happen within us. We begin to feel this natural seasonal change of something emerging, something flowering. And then the buds that are on the tree and the flowers that are emerging out of the soil are smiling at us, inviting us to see them. It says in the Quran, am I not your Lord, to which we the creation say, yes, we witness you. And so we go through life in kind of a receptive way of observing this presence unveiling itself endlessly anew. And then suddenly the raindrops that fall have a meaning. And it's all a gospel. And a gospel means the good news. It's all the good news that this is the life that we've been given. And in this holy instant of this breath, we can rejoice and be glad in it. And so I invite you to come in, for those of you who are in the back of the room. And for those of you who are here, I invite you to open your eyes and to be here now in this beautiful dance of life. There are no accidents. And this morning on my Zen calendar, it was Thich Nhat Hanh who said something miserably funny and tragically true for so many of us. He said this, people have a hard time letting go of their suffering. Out of a fear of the unknown, they would prefer suffering because that is familiar with them. Or as Shakespeare would say, and so we'd rather bear those ills we have than fly to others we know not of. And thus conscience doth make cowards of us all. And thus the native hue of resolution to change and evolve is sicklied o'er by the pale cast of thought. I'm a victim, I'll stay a victim, and I'll identify with it because I'm familiar with that. And enterprises of great pitch and motion with this regard, their currents turn awry and lose the name of action. We stay in the suffering place because it's familiar. Now, any of you know long-held sufferers? My friend Terry Shea is doing this thing on elders in Canada, and I'm supposed to be with him on this Zoom experience this afternoon for 2 hours. And he wrote a whole list of questions that I'm supposed to answer. Who's inspired you? Who? And in reflecting on it over these many years, I'm talking about a new design for living. What if there are always those in the background who were pushing the envelope to be an authentic expression of your true nature? One of my first ancestors that inspired me so much was Ralph Waldo Emerson. Anne Marie has the same respect for him because he was somebody who would die to this old identification. Remember, he was a minister at the First Church in Boston, a very prestigious position that his father had held. And he was quite famous at a young age until he realized, I can't do that anymore. It doesn't fit my soul. And his very last sermon in front of this audience was called The Last Supper. And it was all about Easter. And next week is Easter. This is Palm Sunday. Yeah. In fact, my very first sermon was given at the center, 1989, on Easter at the old building. And I remember my very first talk was Have Your Own Resurrection. In other words, let's take it out of something that happened 2,000 years ago into a lived experience. Now, to have a resurrection, that means to be born into a new way of seeing. But in order to have that, you have to have a crucifixion. You have to die to something in order to be born into something new. And so what if that idea of the long-held sufferer is an identification that so many of us have until we don't anymore? We're not a victim. And then you learn, one of the very first teachings I learned from this teaching is there are no victims, there are only volunteers. So something in us chooses to identify with that label or that mask, and then we carry it around to the world. Helen Street, she was another one of my elders, she would go around like this, and she said, people come with their story. And they say, you want to hear my story? Oh, it's really traumatic, my childhood and this, and oh, and you can go on and on and on about your story. And Helen would say, why don't you give me your story for now, and I'll just put it down over here. No, I couldn't let it go. She said, I'll give it back to you when you're ready to leave. So let's just put it down over here, and let's see what's arising now without the story, without the need to be the long-held sufferer. Well, then there is just a glimpse of the possibility what life might be like when we're consciously choosing to set ourselves free in a new design for living. Today, I'm exploring the idea of shedding the masks that we wear. You know, we all wear masks. I've taught so many classes, and one of the elders for me was a man named Joseph Campbell, who taught the power of myth. And he said, a myth is something that never happened, but is always happening. Now, don't you love things like that? What do you mean? Something that never happened that's always happening. Well, we're all in this myth called life. You know, the crucifixion and the resurrection. That's something that we try on personally. The virgin birth. What in us needs to give birth from that innocent place within us? Is it the Christ consciousness? So I remember when I give classes, they always have a final project. And in Joseph Campbell's class, they were all to write their own personal myth. Now, at that time, maybe 30 years ago, I wrote my own personal myth. And I remember what came through me back then was I was a little boy who grew up in the Midwest who wanted the world's approval. This was that old design for living, to be a success. I was valedictorian, first in my class. I was an actor. I was all these things because I had become a somebody. And that was my design for living. And then I become this minister here in Alabama. And then I realize as I'm writing the myth that I had a backpack that I wore. And in that backpack were all the masks that I was to wear. The perfect son, the mask of the consummate student, the mask of the minister, the mask of a devoted husband, the mask of all this. And I had them all in my backpack in this myth. But then when I went to get the mask and put it on again, the mask kept falling off. They wouldn't stay anywhere. And so I realized I can't hide behind these masks anymore. They're crippling me. I was sharing with Michael, I got a letter here in the mailbox this morning from my high school reunion. And maybe I'll take Mary with me because my husband won't go. And it's their 55th reunion and they're begging me to attend. Now I was closeted back then with all the masks on. And Michael said it might be good for me to go and take all the masks off and let me. And I don't know if I have the courage to get out there on the dance floor, Mary, and let them see who I really am because I had so indoctrinated them because of who I was at the school at that time. I'm not him anymore. So in this lovely little book, Things That Join the Sea and the Sky, Mark Nepo talks about the masks that we wear in not such a complimentary way. And this is what he says. Masks suffocate who we are. He said, the harshness of experience makes us put them on as coverings because we think we can hide behind the mask. They protect us. As thin as veils, and as thick as armor, in hopes that these coverings, these masks, will protect us from the suddenness of life, because we're afraid to be seen for who we are, so we'd rather let them see who we would pretend to be. But the masks ultimately imprison you behind the identification of who you want the world to see you as. So he goes on to say this, deeply thankful. Now, this is a man who survived cancer twice. What a blessing. Deeply thankful to be here after my cancer, I was forced to remove the masks so that I could once again be touched and surprised by life. In a strange sort of way, nearly dying brought me to living. And he says, ultimately, masks are temporary band-aids until we find a way to trust our native gifts from within so that we all put on masks. It's part of being human, and the work is to take them off once we've learned to be strong enough to trust who we are. To trust who we are, we can take them off. We don't have to hide behind them anymore. Now, having said that, we all have them. We all wear them in life. You know, my husband was a school teacher. He put on the mask of a school teacher, but he was a fearful school teacher because at the time, people made comments about gay people and children and pedophilia. And so he was afraid to be an openly gay teacher. He had to be a closeted teacher wearing a mask so that he wouldn't be judged as deviant, if you will. And so what if, even in Alabama now, the don't say gay law, I guess I could go to jail for saying that I'm a gay minister here in Huntsville, Alabama. Now I could start wearing the mask, Anne-Marie. I could pretend like I used to. And I remember when I started ministry, so many of you were here at the time. I came, once they selected me to be the minister and the congregation was down to half. And I said, what happened, Barbara? And I think it was Judy that sweetly said, well, some of them had an issue with you being gay, so they couldn't handle it, so they left. And I thought, if I had known that, I probably wouldn't have come. So it's a good thing you didn't tell me, because I came, and I spoke to the ones who weren't afraid of that. And you know, it's not who I really am, it's just part of who I am. Like, I'm a white male. Now that's the strangest damn thing. Can you imagine why I would incarnate as a white male? I think it's because that's the last thing I wanted to come back as. So when you begin to see yourself as a universal being, then in a strange sort of way, you can kind of bless the life that you've been given. Trying to figure things out, and I have a little mental part of me, Terry girl and Terry boy. My grandfather, David Leonard, died before I was born, and my mother said he was the kindest, and he was a new thought person, which is what this is, and he gave my mother Lessons in Truth by Emily Cady, and I begin to think maybe I'm him reincarnated, that he needed another go-around, and I think he was probably a homophobe. That's why I came back as a gay man. He was... Obviously, he loved to dance. He died on a dance floor at age 45 with another woman in his arms. So I came back as a dancer, and I began to smile to the consequence of this continuation of life. Beloved Thich Nhat Hanh made his transition, and at the end of his life, all he spoke about was how I'm not going to die. He says, spirit doesn't die. Spirit continues on. So instead of saying happy birthday, you say happy continuation day. So when Anastasia has her little dog, Pepper. I couldn't accept her when she showed up at my doorstep because she was the spitting image of my own baby Speck. But still, when I see her, I see baby Speck embodied in this troublesome little dog. I mean, Speck nearly chewed up the whole house. And when her house was being chewed up, I knew that Speckles was with her, chewing up her house instead of my house. And I could smile to that because, and you know, Trey and I have never really had a pup that we loved more. So sometimes they don't have to be the perfect animal. The other day, Trey got up. He gets up at the crack of dawn. He's reading his newspaper on the front porch. And at 5 a.m., a yellow cat comes to the front porch and is circling his legs and meowing and meowing. And Trey comes in and says, there's this crazy cat who won't leave me. So he closes the front door, and then the cat jumps in the window, and he's talking at me. And it says, you just can't. The cat's talking at the window. So we open the door. The cat runs in the house. So we go, oh, what, you know, this cat, he's got a bell on him, but he's got no identification. So we take the pug out. It's still dark out. We're waddling, and the cat chases us around the side yard into the alleyway. And Chris, his lights go on. And I said, he's Mr. Catmaster over there. So I knock on the door. I saw the lights were on. And the little cat jumped from the stone wall down into the alley and right over to Chris and Letitia. And I said, you got yourself a new cat. They picked him up. He started to purr. Well, Trey went on neighborhood things, and this woman had lost her cat for 4 days. She's been crying, his name is this, his name is this. And Trey said, I think he's got a bobtail. So within, still pitch black out, she pulls in front of the house. She's running down the street screaming his name. And she thinks he's at our house. I said, no, he's not at our house. He's at their house. So instead of getting in her car and driving over there, she left it running in front of our house, and she's running down the street crying his name out. And she gets her cat back. But then she's panicked because her cat's a wanderer. He's not, you talk about a fence to keep him in. This cat, she got him 2 weeks ago at the pound, and he's looking for his owner out there somewhere in the world. And so she's tormented. Is this my cat, or is this the world's cat? And so you live in the beautiful question that doesn't have an answer. You know, it's the Talmud that said, why ruin a perfectly good question with an answer? So what if we're not here to find solutions to life, but we're here to be teachable and explore this mystery of what's it all about? Why am I here? To experience this evolution of consciousness, which is what it's really all about. And if you are here, it's because something in you said, yes, I am willing to grow. I'm willing to evolve. I'm willing to die to a false sense of self, and I'm willing to let something new emerge in me. I'm willing to shift into freedom, even if that freedom means that I have to let go of everything that I've held on to in order to experience something that's unfamiliar. Because remember, the pain body likes its suffering. It identifies with its suffering. I taught a class here one summer. It was one of my favorites. It's by a man named Locke Kelly, who comes out of the global tradition of Buddhism and Hinduism, and his little book was called Shift into Freedom, The Science and Practice of Open-Hearted Awareness. And he's so simple in his scientific way. He says, unhook from thought, because that's where our attention usually is. And then he says, allow yourself to fall into this open-hearted awareness. Now, that's what we had when we held the cat in our arms, and he's purring in Letitia's arms. That's an open-hearted awareness. The head wants to figure out, what am I going to do? No, no, don't go to the head. Just stay in this heart place. And he talks about what those masks look like. And this can be helpful to Terry Boy, who has a lot of different voices in his head. This is what he says about that in a very loving way. He says, our ego identification is not a single character. You talk about masks, but it's the me system that's composed of many different sub-personalities. We have all these different masks that we identify as, you know, controlling Curtis, fearful Freddy, all these sub-personalities. And they rotate through the driver's seat of our mind. Listen to this, Terry. They rotate through the driver's seat of our mind, and they want to steer our life. So we discover that these voices or sub-personalities are normal patterns of thought and feelings that most human beings have. And we share them with each other. These patterns or habits of the mind, they need to be liberated. Not just stopped. You can't stop them. So they're still going to arise. You know, that judgmental Judy who has concerns about her new house, she's still going to be there, but Susan can smile at her. Now, there you are, Judy. He says, when we know and see from beingness or from this open-hearted awareness, he says, then our sub-personalities feel relieved that they no longer have to act as the driver of our life. So Freddie doesn't need to drive the car. Yes, you have some fears there, but they're not real. They're just a creation from your past conditioning. So with this awake awareness as our ground of beingness, then the voices and opinions, they'll still arise. But they don't become the driver of our consciousness. Instead, they're welcomed and unburdened by a loving presence and an open-hearted awareness. You love them. They're there. So when Pepper comes to you and she's in her fearful little place, you don't shame her for being fearful. You just put your arms around her. You know, baby Speck was so much like Pepper, and Speckles wanted to be free. And so she chased a rabbit through a hole in a fence. And then she was too big to get back through the hole in the fence. And she found herself on the top of a quarry where there was water down below, and she it's either fall into the quarry or go back through the hole, and she couldn't get through the hole. Well, she stood there, and she looked around. Well, what am I supposed to do? And then Trey, in his well-meaning, fatherly way, he climbed up from the quarry, up to the top of the hill, and he carried her down the hill so that he could set her free. So what if life gives you these moments where you get to feel a connection, because the head would probably freak out, what am I going to do? But the open-hearted awareness said, I'm just going to enter into it, and something will guide me through this, and we'll listen to it. And all of life is kind of like that. You know, we show up for the moment, and there is inherent within us the capacity to meet what is and not call it a bad thing. It's just a thing. And then we have a way to navigate. I was sharing with you that Stephen Jenkinson did a beautiful video called Dying Well, and he says, we live in a culture that's fearful about death. And he says, until we embrace death, we can't really embrace life. And one of his jobs, he kind of looked like you, Terry, kind of like an old hippie with long hair and a beard, and he said, I got a job working for hospice. And he says, you know, I failed miserably at that job. You know why I failed miserably? He said, because I'm here to help them make peace with dying, and nobody wants to die. and they don't want to get old. They want to stay young, proverbial young, and they want to live forever. Instead of when you embrace that the moment we're born, our death is a given. So could we live every day as if this is a good day to die? Well, then life has a way of being such a blessing because we know that we aren't going to die. And that's an elder speaking. So Stephen Jenkinson does all this kind of desire to recognize those who are the embodiment of a consciousness that is moving us forward in a proactive sort of way. When I was a brand new minister, before I was a minister, a lady named Louise Hay came to Atlanta, Georgia, and this was in like 1985 when the AIDS crisis was at its peak. And there were a lot of gay individuals in the church where I spawned, and several of them had AIDS. And so she came, and she had the wisdom of an elder at a fairly young age because she had herself healed herself from cancer. And she wrote a book called You Can Heal Your Life. And it's how she empirically did the healing work on herself. And so she came to offer her wisdom from the heart. It's empirical knowledge, means that she's lived through it. And the first thing she said is we have to learn to love ourselves just where we are, in the midst of the cancer, in the midst of the AIDS crisis. And you know, we in a culture that's kind of self-loathing. And her simple practice was to hand people a mirror and say, look into the eyes of that person and tell that person you love them and you accept them just the way they are. And almost without exception, people couldn't do that. I remember going home after that workshop and she said, this is your homework, to put your hands on the two faucets of the sink and look into the eyes of that person every morning and to say to that person, I love you and I accept you just the way you are. That's harder than you think it is. I tried it and I had a difficult time doing it because we're so programmed into kind of a self-loathing, this judgmental, you could do better, you should know better, all that kind of voices in the head, instead of with all your flaws, I love you and I accept you. And that's just the beginning, because then part of the healing from this wise teacher, in order to shed the mask, you have to do the forgiveness work. You have to forgive yourself. You have to forgive everyone that you've judged as maybe has hurt you. I forgive myself. I forgive all past experience. In forgiving myself, in forgiving my past, I am free. I am free. But it's harder to do than we think it is, because we tend to hold on. And she says, if we don't forgive, we live in that prison of self-righteous resentment, and we're bound to die in that prison. So it's imperative for us, not them, that we forgive them. When we forgive them, we forgive ourselves. We set ourselves free to love again. Now, we get to explore that for ourselves. What are we hiding behind? What masks have we donned in order to protect ourselves? You know? And could we be willing to let that mask go for however long it is and discover that vulnerable self, that innocent self? I love when Jean Ann shared this morning how her little girl always wanted to wear hot pink sneakers, but her mother or grandmother said they were gaudy. And so now in her 40s, she's donning the hot pink sneakers because she can. And she hasn't have somebody saying, oh, it's trashy. You look like a you-know-what by wearing those hot pink sneakers with those hooped earrings. She says, now my little girl can put them on and I don't have to have their approval. I can know that I'm okay to express myself. I shared with you, Linnell, at age 70, has now found his inner woman. He's put on his makeup and his gown, and he's singing the song, I'm Coming Out. It took him 70 years to get to that place where he could set himself free and didn't have to feel ashamed by expressing something that was inherent within him that the whole world had condemned. So what if we get to take off the masks and discover who we are? Ken Burns, who did the Civil War. To me, he is someone who is helping us create this new order of being. And he's done a recent documentary on Benjamin Franklin, and it is quite profound, because Benjamin Franklin, unbeknownst to so many of us, was an elder of our country who, and he became an elder, according to Ken Burns, because he could evolve, he could grow. When Ben Franklin, he only had 2 years of education. He was a self-taught man, and he was very attached to England as his home country, and he went back and forth. In fact, he wanted to move to England. He left his wife in Philadelphia, and he was big in English society, and so he went back and forth on that, on the boat. You know, it took like 3 months back and forth, and then he realized that this series of colonies, these 13 colonies, were almost like slaves to Great Britain. And so he shifted the way he saw it. Instead of being loyal to Great Britain and the king, and this kind of hierarchy of white men usurping the indigenous people with slaves, he began to see things with new eyes. And what really transformed him was he worked with the indigenous people, the Creek Indians and the Cherokee Indians and the Algonquin Indians. And we called them, as white men, we called them savages. Well, Ben Franklin discovered that the savages had a system where they all got along with one another. They had treaties. They respected each other's territories. And he looked at these 13 colonies, and Ben Franklin said, either we join or we die. Either those 13 individual colonies need to come together in one voice, you might say United States, or they'll perish. So he was the voice that says we have to come together as one voice, as one country, and we have to step out of this almost false identification as Europeans, because nothing about America really is European. We came over here, and then Ken Burns so beautifully said, our founding fathers were the renegades that fled the country. They were the unhealthy ones. They were the victims that had seen themselves oppressed in the various countries. They came here to create a new order, but they carried with them the same patterns of domination, of a hierarchy of thinking, of an aristocratic mentality. And here you had these indigenous people that were so different, the true Americans. And we called them savages because we had this Christian idea that we were superior to them. Now, the beautiful thing is, in this documentary, you see how Ben Franklin evolved from a scientist, from a teacher, to a humanitarian, to a voice of evolution, and asking us to evolve as a species. Now that's what all of this is about, to have this new design for living. We have to begin to see things in a different way, not the way that things have always been. I'm going to be asked on this interview today, he wrote all these questions out, and one of them is, in Centers for Spiritual Living, how do they honor the elders? And what is the role of the elders within CSL? And as I was reflecting on that, they don't really have a role. We don't really honor the elders in our tribe, as I think they should be in so much of the world, because we've become institutional. I think of Francis, Pope Francis, as an elder, and he is speaking a language that isn't institutional. He's getting a lot of cardinals and bishops angry at him because he's speaking from the heart. And he's willing to defy the powers that be in order to serve something that is so much bigger. Now, could we be a voice of that new design of something bigger, a new way of seeing things? There's this documentary, I don't even know what it's called. It's about a man in Hollywood who was at a time when the gay thing was really undercovers. Nobody talked about it. And he wrote a book and he exposed the underbelly of Hollywood and the gay culture that was in the 1920s and 1930s. And it's kind of one of those tell-all things. But as someone in 2022, it's always been closeted. It's always been hidden. Now, when you expose the truth, is that, should we not tell the truth about Katharine Hepburn and all these people that we have this illusory idea hiding behind the masks of who they wanted the world to see and then to discover that they were more complicated, more multidimensional? And then there's a beautiful saying my teacher used to say, the truth will set you free. He says, but first it ticks you off. He uses a different phrase. It's a little more crude. I won't say it. Yeah, it sets you free, the truth. We don't want to hear the truth so often. You know, we've all been raised in families of denial, where we created the mask and the image that our family wanted the world to see, until you say, no, our family wasn't like that. Our family was troubled. We had issues in our family. My dad had an addiction problem, but my mother also had an addiction problem. Her addiction was she didn't want the world to know what we were hiding behind. And so we were all masters of wearing the masks, until, like I discovered in that Joseph Campbell class, I couldn't put the masks on anymore. My mother would come and visit me, and she would say, well, everybody asks about you, Scott, in the hometown where I came from. I said, so what do you tell them, Mom? Oh, I don't tell them anything. It's none of their business. I said, oh. I said, have you told them I'm a minister? No, because they would ask too many questions, and I don't want to answer. I said, well, have you told them about Trayvon? No. It's none of their business who you live with. And so I said, so we're still wearing the mask, and you want me to come back? Shall I see if I can find some masks to wear when I go to the high school reunion? Or not? And Michael's smiling at me because he said, there's an opportunity there for you, David. But you don't have to always take the opportunities that life gives you, do you? Sometimes you get to pick and choose. And that's that free will to be who we are. So in the Sufi tradition, they have such a simple, profound way of creating a new design for living. They say the willingness to let go of your identification. So the first thing you would let go of your attachments. So you might start, I'd be sitting across from Nancy, and Nancy would be sitting across from me, and so she'd say, it's your turn, David, and I'd say, okay, Nancy, I'm willing to let go of my attachment to my beautiful home. I'm willing to let go of my attachment to the beautiful gardens that I have around the home. I'm willing to let go of the attachment I have to the center, which I feel is so sacred. I'm willing to let go of my attachment to, my books. My God knows I've got a lot of books. I'm willing to let go of my attachment to my little car that serves me well, and the old truck that we've had forever. It was our first vehicle. She's a 1986 truck. I'm willing to let go of my attachment to people, to my beloved friends, to my beloved brother Raul, who's been having challenges this week, and I realized how attached I am to him. So I'm willing to let go of the attachment to him and to Gigi and to the pug. And, you know, and once you start letting go of the attachment to stuff, then you get to let go of your attachment to the labels that you identify yourself. I'm willing to let go of my attachment to Dr. Reverend David Leonard. I'm willing to let go of my attachment to Mr. and Mr. whatever we are, and to Trey as my beloved husband, and to Michael as my beloved son. I'm willing to let go of all these attachments. And once you do this purging thing, then the question is that Nancy would say, now who are you? And, you know, there's a pregnant pause there. Well, who am I without all my masks and my identification? Well, that's who I've identified with, and now I'm none of that. Well, who am I, Michael? And he'd smile, and he'd say, yeah, that's who you are. And he'll send me a picture of Herman. And then Herman's smiling at me. And I'm like, well, that's who I am. I'm that goofy smile coming through that dog's face, and I can see myself. Well, I like that person. Well, and then we go back into the contraction self. Well, but I've spent so much time with all those degrees. They define me. They make me important. They give me accountability so I can get a good salary because I have this identification and credentials. How many of you had to fill out a job application and, you know, put in all your qualifications for the job? When I was in New York City and I graduated from college and I'd done a lot of musicals and theater in college, as, you know, just for fun. And when I got to New York City and I wanted to audition for things, you had to create a resume. And so you would put all these things and you felt like you were standing in front of like you had to go out there and perform and you had to be a somebody, and they'd look at your qualifications and they'd decide if you were, it was a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And then you realize, I'm none of that. That's not who I am. I'm not my resume. I am something that's fresh and alive. And so could we know, look at Zelensky, when he became the president of Ukraine, he did not have the qualifications other than he took a role in a TV series called Servant of the People, and he played the role of someone who was there to serve the masses and to hear the masses. And out of that self-fulfilling prophecy, he was catapulted, almost like the phoenix rising from the ashes of Ukraine, which was a corrupt country filled with oligarchs, and autocracy. And he said, that's all corrupt, and I'm standing for freedom. I'm standing for the voice of the people in a yellow and blue sort of way. And look what happened. He is a man for the time. Gene Houston calls people like him evolutionary throw forwards. Jesus was an evolutionary throw forward. He was someone that was telling them to love one another, to love the enemy, to do good to those who harm you. You know, he died at 31, 2, 3, because he was speaking a language that was far more revolutionary than we were ready to hear. And as my teacher Kennedy used to say, he said, Jesus came 2,000 years ago to point the way, and for 2,000 years we've been worshiping his finger. It was not about Jesus. It was about this message of the willingness to enter into the heart of the one and to see that we're all connected. And Jesus would say simple things that are like throwaway lines. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. If you've seen Michael, you've seen the divine presence. It's all the divine presence. And he was saying that. He said, I of myself do nothing. It's this presence within, call it the Father, the Beloved, that does everything. So he was recognizing that we are conduits, we are instruments for the divine. And then when life gives you an experience like a strange little cat showing up, who is lost, who is seeking its owner, then we can either turn the door on that little cat, or we can open our heart and we can have that experience. And who is it for? It's for all of us. We're all here walking each other home. You know, we have a little sign in the classroom that says, go is the Sangha, go is the river. And it's penned by Thich Nhat Hanh. And his little calligraphies point to something so much bigger. The Sangha is the community of oneness. We're all the same. We're all the ocean of love here. And so if I want to identify as the drop, well, then I've separated my drop from Lee's drop. But there is no drop of Lee and drop of David. There's only this ocean of love endlessly revealing itself in the wake of life. There's that word wake again. Every wake is a death so that a new birth can go. And so to awaken, paradoxically, we need to die. And what if the 12-step program, which is also called a religion, is pointing in a very simplistic way to a death of this old way of thinking into this new order of being? No longer a victim of the addictions of life. And the greatest addiction we have is me. That's the big addiction. In this shift yourself from freedom, he says, we're addicted to me and all the many aspects of me. And that beautiful Stephen Jacobson, or what is his last name? Jenkinson, strange name, Stephen Jenkinson, he said self-absorption, and so much of the world is self-absorbed, he says is truly self-hatred, because then you're really hating the self that we merge as from the one self, and this little self gets to just surrender into that. You know, we in the Western world have a hard time with the idea of surrender, because surrender happens when you're not there. The best definition I've heard of surrender happens when the me isn't there. And it just naturally happens. Then, so you surrender into the eyes of love. You surrender into the arms of your little pug in the bed. You know, he loves to get under the covers. He likes to sleep late, and we get up early. And so I have to get the day going, and I go upstairs around 7 o'clock. Chris can appreciate this, and he's under the covers, his little head sticking out. And I said, you know, it's time to get up. I don't want to get up, he says. He looks at me with that one eye of his. And so I took the covers away from him, and he rolls over on his back. Well, it's time to rub my belly now and to rub my chest. I said, I know, and you want me to just cuddle up with you and you can cozy in for another hour or so. And I scoop him up. Well, now I guess I have to get up and go. So I carry him down the stairs, and he sits by the door, dutifully waiting for his opportunity to do his business. And it was Lee that said, it's those simple things, or maybe it was Nancy, those simple things in life that become such sacred things. And so let me do a little closing meditation. If my brother Raul will go back to the bell. I try to begin on time and end on time. It was Raymond Charles Barker that said, order is the first law of the universe. And you know, something in us loves order. I know I do. Trey was a school teacher, and he said one thing he found out with his students is they don't want chaos. Adam was telling me that he and his wife went to this thing with their son, and he said, I thought of you, David, because everything was in chaos. People were screaming, standing in line, tires were spinning, and everybody was in chaos. And he said, I just smiled and said, I'm going to be the place of peace and quiet. So what if that's the opportunity in any moment when chaos is all around us, and it is, to find that center place where we can find this new design for living, by taking off the masks of yesterday and realize we haven't really lost anything, because they're still in the backpack. You can pull them out if you need them until you can't. And what I'd learned in that metaphor of mine, I couldn't put them on anymore. So I guess I'm not going to the high school reunion. Raul, if you would. The mindfulness bell. Throughout our day, find those sacred moments of stopping. And then just be in that moment. Because all we have is the moment. In our beloved class, Thich Nhat Hanh says, all you ever have is the moment. And when you realize that, well, then the moment has the capacity to expand into eternity. And so just by stopping, we can experience the cosmic I am. I am is the name of God, if you will. And so all there is this I am. The I's can be individualized, but the am is universal. So maybe it's just all am. And if you're from India, you can say om. Om. Am. The sound of the universe vibrating within its creation. And my beloved Terry Boy said, energy follows thought. But what if we're not thinking anymore? What happens to the energy? Now, why destroy a perfect question with an answer? So what is the energy? Let's call it the Holy Spirit. The life force. Huh. In the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus said, you can destroy the Father and you can destroy the Son and you will be fine. But if you destroy the Holy Spirit, you shall perish. Let those who have ears to hear, hear. And so when we experience ourselves as the energy of the divine, then we feel into that. What would the energy of the divine in us right now feel like? It feels like a cat purring in my arms. When Smudge made her transition, my little kitty, she went to baby Speck's bed in a very sacred time. And I lay down next to her. And she was so fragile and so weak. And I put my little finger on her neck and rubbed it up and down. And she purred, took all her strength to give me that purr. And then she gave her last breath. And in that sacred experience, she showed me how to live by not running away from death, but by embracing it as a part of life. And so as we shift out of the mindset, the energy begins to follow an intuitive guidance system. Thich Nhat Hanh calls it an insight. And the insight arrives from the part of us that sees things clearly, no longer compartmentalized as right or wrong, good or bad. That's dualistic thinking. But we've actually stepped into non-dual thinking, where we need the darkness in order to experience the light. We need the death in order to have the resurrection. And then we begin to see life in a different way altogether. We're not afraid of death. We can die to every breath and know that there's a new breath on the horizon. We can die to every moment, knowing that the next moment is waiting for us to celebrate and to be and to see things with new eyes, not with the eyes of the victim that wants to identify with the pain body and continue suffering in a habitual way. But there's a new design for living where we unhook from thought, where we smile, where we step out on the dance floor of life and we're willing to dance as if no one is watching. And I hear that Leonard Cohen song, Dance Me to the End of Love. And so in that abstract way of perceiving, we see that life is a dance and we are dancing in this energy of love. And in every moment, it asks us to set ourselves free, to not be controlled, to not care about what people think, to take off all the masks of our false identity, and to be naked in the soul. Even the word naked has connotations around it. We're so afraid to be vulnerable and exposed as a naked soul, no longer need the protection of labels and masks, but to just stand in open-hearted awareness as one with everything and one with nothing. It was Nisargadatta that said, when I know that I am nothing, then wisdom begins to flower within me. And when I know that I'm everything, well, then love awakens within me. And so we're nothing, we're no thing separate from every other thing. And yet we are spiritual beings. We are this energy of the Holy Spirit moving through a vehicle called this body, called this mind, called this life form that we've been given through grace, here to live for a period of time as a form, and then to transition into a different energy. The Holy Spirit will never die, and that's what we are. So I invite you to smile to all those who may have been here before, who are still here now, to feel them alive within you, because truly they do live within us, the ancestors. And to know that we are on a journey a journey of breathing, one breath and then the next breath, a journey of stopping and seeing what is, and not judging it as right or wrong, but embracing it as the sacred path where we take one step at a time. And there's a beautiful saying in the Sufi tradition, you take one step toward God, and God comes running toward you. So on Sunday mornings, we take a step within to discover that holy presence within ourselves, knowing that it rejoices and comes running to us like that little cat that leapt up into Letitia's arms. That's what the divine does when we're ready to receive the grace of every single moment. I invite you to place your hand on your heart as we're going to join together in the heart salutation, saying to this presence within and all around, I honor you. I respect you. I love you. You are the transformative power of the universe, ever emerging through its creation, flowering as truth, liberating as hope, courageous as yes, courageous as yes, 1,000 times yes. And in that yes, we embrace all. We open our eyes, we open our hands, we say yes to this incredible life with all of its beautiful nuances. Thanks for sending in your tithes out there. Have fun. It's not easy to go through transformation. I get texts from Adam every day saying, oh my God, oh my God. I said, yes, this is your destiny. You have to be willing to die to the false self in order for this new self to emerge. It's essential. Hallelujah. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. More information, please visit www.cslhuntsville.org.